everybody, to the last breakout session of the 2006 Unsung Symposium. You're in session 364, Integral Mormonism, Esoteric Perspectives of the Mormon Tradition, with John Kessler and Lisa Hansen. I've got major bios here for both of these folks. I'm just going to tell you that they're great friends. John kind of came into my life 3 or 4 years ago through Mary Beth Raines and a kind of a mutual interest in Ken Wilber. Many of you may have seen that on his bio, and he also taught a workshop there. But John is one of the co-founders of the spiritual part of the Integral Institute, right, with the Institute of Integral Spirituality. He works closely there, and I believe that this presentation came in, I don't know if you're going to tell the story, but kind of out of an impromptu invitation by Ken to kind of talk to the heart of Mormonism, to all these people whose traditions have this long venerated history of these deep esoteric insights. And I know that John was very surprised to be invited up there, but what he's come up with is very powerful. And I know that Lisa shared with me how much she enjoyed the paper and receiving it in advance and kind of letting the insights there. John is an attorney, he's a consultant. He works, right now with, Healthy Communities Building. He's just one of these amazing people that Sunstone is just like, how do you get somebody of this caliber here? So I really, really enjoy him. Lisa Hansen and her husband Bill have become friends probably a little bit longer, probably known 5 or 6 years now. My wife and I just would rather go to dinner with these guys and spend time because they're such uplifting people. I asked her to respond to John because I know her strong interest in spirituality and development of spirituality, and especially in some, I guess you call it esoteric, but sort of the deep consciousness. She, in addition to assisting her husband, who's an attorney, she's a legal secretary there. She does hypnotherapy. I've had a chance to become very relaxed after a session with Lisa. I never wanted to leave, but it was wonderful. She's musical. She was valedictorian of BYU's College of Family Science in 1990, when she had 6 children. She's smart, she's articulate, and I know you guys are going to do it, so I'm going to leave right now. And John, take it away, Lisa, and then the questions afterwards.
Thank you, Darren. In the very first issue of Sunstone, there was a story about a young man who was living in Harlem in New York City as a community activist, neighborhood builder, also going to law school, an aggressive and outspoken atheist. And through a real strange combination of happenstances, he ended up looking into the Mormon Church and had a very dramatic, almost Joseph Smith-like experience. The interesting thing, though, was that his confirmation, say, for instance, of the Book of Mormon, was not about its literalness. It was something about the spiritual field that was created by it, sort of a depth of awareness, a depth of holding a spiritual space. And he was really conflicted because he ended up joining the Mormon Church without believing half of the truth claims in the Mormon Church. And it was a little bit of a paradox for everybody around him and for himself, and yet he just had such a dramatic confirmation of the spiritual truthfulness that came out of the Book of Mormon, and having some life-changing opportunities to actually live the gospel and observe the fruits of his life. And that was a story about me many, many years ago, back around 1970 or so. Roll the decades forward, several decades, to a little less than a decade ago. I was still doing community activist work. I was running a national organization called the Coalition for Healthier Cities and Communities, and had a grant to bring all the various community movements together to try to find a way to connect them in their common themes: so livable communities, sustainable communities, all of these. There's about a dozen of them. And based on this spiritual field that I still held and contemplated in and prayed through, I was able to pick up some real wisdom about community work. For instance, usually you're a communalist or you're an individualist, and never the twain shall meet. It sort of defines your politics. And yet the Mormon tradition, the Mormon field, would say you need to be radically open, radically an individual. You are your own channel to truth, and at the same time, community is tremendously important. And so I'd write papers and give little talks, and it sounded very paradoxical about how to have more community by having less community. And I had picked up some years before that a fellow by the name of Ken Wilber kind of talked like this and wrote like this, and he talked about an integral awareness where you could hold multiple perspectives. And I really found an intellectual home that I frankly hadn't found within the church or the scholarship of the church or people I knew who were LDS or anywhere else, about a certain level of awareness that all of a sudden things that seem to be paradoxical or opposite really fit together. There's a higher way of holding a space. And I began to understand in that context something that Les Kripke quoted from Leonard Arrington in a response he made on Thursday. Let me just read it. Because of my introduction to the concept of symbolism as a means of expressing religious truth, I never was preoccupied with the question of historicity of the first vision, but the evidence is overwhelming that it did occur, or of the many recorded epiphanies in Mormon, Christian, and Indian history. I'm prepared to accept them as historical or as metaphorical, as symbolical, or as precisely what happened. That they convey religious truth is the essential issue, and of this I never had any doubt. Inevitable experiences, messages, and value affirmations do not always lend themselves to scientific or literal or precise articulation. It does not bother me at all that in describing a religious experience that transcends his ability to express it, a narrator, a testimony giver, often resorts to traditional phrases in presenting it. Indeed, I do it myself, as those who have heard me speak in testimony means can vouch. The Italians have a useful expression for this sort of thing, which I won't say in Italian, which means roughly, what is literally true or not is still true. It helped me understand be mature enough to understand the paradox I lived in for a long time. But, well, I'm not sure I can accept everything historically true, maybe lots of things literally. But there is something about being kind of a postmodern Mormon, where you can gather the truth of something out of the narrative of it, out of the spiritual field that it sources, and arguing about faith or historicity, faith or reason is oftentimes not even the right conversation to have. And in this time of understanding this framework more deeply, Ken Wilber called me up and said, "Hey, I've read some of your stuff. We're putting together a think tank called the Integral Institute. Would you be interested in helping us get it started?" And so I did that, coming in through sort of the community side. About at the same time, I, being an attorney, have to get continuing legal education credits. And I went to a workshop for mediators. There was a little breakout session by a Zen master called Genpo Roshi, who has the largest Zen lineage in the world, headquartered outside of Japan. And he had moved his headquarters to Salt Lake City. And he had come up with this facilitation process called the Big Mind Process, to give Westerners particularly, who had such a strong sense of ego, we had a hard time breaking through to this Eastern non-dual enlightened perspective or state of awareness. And he came up with this procedure, this little protocol to help facilitate people into this state. And an hour and a half later, I kind of staggered out of this session, having had this incredible experience. And I was in this non-dual state, and I frankly couldn't get out of it. I was stuck in it for a couple of weeks. Just, I thought, you know, I think I've gone crazy. But he tells me this is some place I'm supposed to be. But it's a very different place to be. And as he's become famous doing this, he's gone all over the world, meeting with thousands and tens of thousands of people with their facilitation. With this facilitation technique, he's never really had anybody have that kind of a response before. But for some reason, I was able to kind of access this non-dual space and hold it really well, which is unusual. I don't know, freak of nature situation or what, but he thought that in the first several years of coming up with it, all sorts of Zen masters and Zen teachers and people would be able to do this facilitation process. But 4 years later, there were only four people that he had certified and was satisfied could really hold the space and facilitate large groups. There were two abbots of Zen monasteries, a Buddhist nun and myself, because I had decided to sort of pursue this, not as a Buddhist, but somebody who wanted to cultivate a capacity to appreciate and embody a particular kind of spiritual space to be in. That led me to introducing Genpo Roshi to Ken Wilber. And Genpo, like the 25 or so other people that Ken Wilber invited to be part of the Integral Spiritual Center just a couple of years ago, were all senior leaders in their traditions. Father Thomas Keating from the Catholic tradition, and Hindu, and Buddhist, and Protestant. And he invited me to be a teacher as well, to show up, and I couldn't quite figure that out, other than I had immediately taken this big mind process and realized that it was so big that it was partial. In other words, it was only the Zen experience is only about this big space. It isn't about the whole spectrum of life and emergence and relationship to others and the whole developmental capacity of being able to function physically, emotionally, and mentally, and have the skills. And I had sort of developed my own unique approach, which Genpo considered a great heresy, but it was really through the spiritual space that I held, this Mormon context of spirituality, that was my filter or my lens to bring meaning and context to this. In the first meeting of the Integral Spiritual Center, most of these teachers had an opportunity to sit up there and say, what is spirituality in my tradition? And I was sitting there next to Ken in the audience, and they were about ready to start, and he looked at me and he said, well, I guess Mormonism is sort of a tradition. You want to name it? I said, okay. You know, being viewed as sort of one of your run-of-the-mill strange fundamentalist groups. I was just sort of a strange representative, not only fundamentalist on site. And but I was able to express what I felt spirituality was, the way I bore my testimony in language they could understand through this framework. And when I was finished, there was just this huge silence. And then later on, people said, you've got to be kidding. I can't imagine that that's what Mormonism is about. Because it's about ascending to greater awareness and divinity. In that ascending, it talks about the descending responsibility of embracing the earth and embracing others. It has a tantric aspect, which only Tibetan Buddhism and Kashmir Shaivism have really developed. And people were just sort of, what is going on here? To make another long story short, out of these 25 teachers, he asked two teachers to sort of be in charge of developing an integral spiritual, bring it all together, kind of an approach for the best of the best. And he asked me and a lineage holder of Kashmir Shaivism to work together to do this. I ended up bowing out because there were so many inherent things that he wanted to teach which would have ranked Mormonism not very high in ways that I didn't agree with, that were crude. And but nevertheless, it was an affirmation to me that this field that I've been carrying and exploring and trying to create some kind of framework to communicate to my own religious community, but also to communicate to the outside world, there was a way to do that. And in a talk that I, or well, a workshop that I gave based on sort of the practices that I put together, there's this quote from Tim Wilbur that says, you know, John Kessler's about this cutting edge thing of East and West like nobody else, and this cutting edge integral. I mean, all I did was take my Mormon framework or the spiritual space that I live within and have deepened and built around it and through it the integral wisdom, and it seems to reflect the depth of the traditions of East and West. And so I'd like to just give you some ideas about some examples of that, that is there. It's not very clear or evident what we might call our exoteric tradition of the doctrines, the Christology that we teach. But it's there in terms of the interconnected undercurrents and patterns of what underlies the entire faith tradition, which for the most part has to do with going on a developmental path towards divinity. And in that process, reaching down, just like God has done for us, to reaching down to others to help them along the way. And so, you know, how do I approach this? Well, I've now kind of come out, and for the last 6 months or so, I'm giving workshops and firesides and doing that kind of thing, trying to encourage this depth and perspective, integrally inform the Mormon tradition, not that there's something new, but say there's something even deeper here than we usually talk about. I've surprisingly been quite successful in having no resistance so far. And then at the same time, I'm trying to develop some practices, cutting-edge integral spiritual practices, based on what I've developed and what I've been trying to pick up from the Integral Spiritual Center. But anyway, here are just some examples. And I asked Dan if he would just cut me off after I've been going on for about 25 minutes. And then Lisa will respond, so we can have enough time just to go where your curiosity might be and to just sort of chat about things. Okay, there's this, the ascending aspect, the descending aspect, and the tantric aspect. The ascending aspect in a physical sense is we talk about the natural man in a very unique way. Is the natural man is an enemy to God, and yet at the same time, there's nothing inherently evil about any aspect of us. It seems contradictory, it seems paradoxical. But the point is, that the Wilbur's vision of the healthiest traditions and of his theories, you transcend and include, you don't transcend and repress. You don't transcend and suppress. You actually include those things which were lower, and so instead of being driven by your carnal proclivities or by your desires, and that's sort of how you regulate your life, you put those in a proper context, a deeper context, a socialized context, a spiritual context, to realize those, all of those energies, whether they're sexual or appetites or whatever they are, they're there for a good reason. There's nothing inherently evil about us. It's only evil or only destructive to the extent that we don't have a framework within which to use those very healthy and life-affirming capacities. That's a very advanced integral concept. It's just fundamental, and sometimes you don't understand the paradox of the natural man, and yet there's nothing evil about us inherently. Part of what I'm also trying to do is say, okay, in this developmental context and in the spiritual space that we have, if we're going to go deeper, we have to be reflective about where we are. And we can use developmental psychology, we can use other traditions to help us be more informed about how we can take next steps on that path to divinity, on that path to a higher realization of ourselves. In the heart area, certainly our church is all about the golden rule and loving your neighbor. And yet developmental psychologists will say a measure of your moral maturity is your scope of caring awareness. And say, for instance, if you live on a block that has a majority of Mormons and a minority of non-Mormons, and you're really happy because you go to the ward and everybody's just great, and you're not aware of the pain that people are suffering because they are being left out, because you're not aware of the power realities in your social and neighborhood and professional life, you have a conventional level of awareness where you're aware of those things within your own tradition, within your own culture, and those outside are kind of a lesser value. You're very not conscious of them. When Mayor Anderson, Rocky Anderson's, and the city sponsored the Bridging the Religious Divide, I took a look at it. I kind of work in this area as a community guy. I finally brought my work home, set up a nonprofit organization called the Salt Lake Center for Engaging Community. And we picked up the bridging work from the city. I decided to say, well, let's see if we can get reasonable Mormon participation in this. Mormon after Mormon after Mormon I talked to said, what problem? I mean, they're wonders. No, this is all about negativity. It's convening together so people can be critical of me. I'm just not going to go deal with it. That's their problem. That's not mine. Conventional moral awareness. The next level up is post-conventional, formal operational understanding. You're able to perceive your culture from outside your culture. And it goes on and on and on. So if we're serious about the developmental aspect of moving towards the divinity, we just need to be aware of being what those steps are and recognize where we are. And it's kind of but if you approach it correctly, people are beginning to be open to this. We've gotten the Canyon Rim Community Council to sponsor some bridging work. We've got two stakes and about 15 wards that are going to participate in the civic bridging project. It's possible. Modes of mysticism, moving from the relational and mental up to the mystical. There are four modalities of spiritual awareness that show up. Almost no traditions hold all four of them or emphasize all four, but an integral approach would say, well, every main modality there is, and an integral approach we should have it. One is called nature mysticism. It's being connected to all things, having a sense of that, having a sense of being outside of space and time. There's a very close correlation to the concept of prophecy. And I know people have challenged me on this in the last couple of days, but I'm just saying, it's my understanding there's a correlation. There's deity mysticism or relational mysticism, where you receive revelatory feedback from the divine. It's all about compassion. God is love. It's communion. It's union. We certainly have that in our church. But all the higher traditions have really worked deeply as far as communing with the Lord, communing with the divine, move beyond petitionary prayer, which is appropriate and wonderful, but to more contemplative and meditative prayer. We don't have any practices in our tradition which really emphasize that. We have wonderful comments from Dave L. McKay or from President Lee and other general authorities encouraging them, saying, I do this in my life. I get up at 5 o'clock and I meditate for an hour. But we don't have practices to cultivate that. There's causal mysticism, pure awareness mysticism. In a way, it's the concept of the witness. You witness everything. There's a witnessing dynamic. We have the concept of the seer as that person who sees as God sees and can see without the filter of ego, and yet it's really in our tradition more a calling of a specific sort related to translating documents. So not very well deeply developed, other than without naming it as such. We have some scriptures and some statements by church authorities that talk about seeing things as they really are, seeing things as God sees them. That's really the witness, although we don't have well-developed practices there. And then the non-dual aspect of mysticism is not in our tradition, as far as I've been able to find it. Sort of being having this radical transformation, it's an interesting thing for me to try to expose our tradition to that. But nevertheless, I think there's real potential. And one thing about people who say, well, then you can't get to the highest levels because you don't have these modalities of spirituality. But these are altered states in a way that are available to anybody at any level. The point is that you translate your state experiences in terms of your level of development. And that brings me to my next point, that one of the great criticisms I hear outside of the church and in the church is polygamy. How can it be true then and it's not true now? And you're opening these revelations where your leaders are saying things are different and you're supposed to have revelation whether it's different. The point is, if you're open to the spiritual field, you're open to the Spirit. If you have altered state experiences that are spiritual modality experiences, you'll tend to translate them in the context of your maturity. Certainly, Joseph Smith had elements of the magical and mystical that are characteristic but not a lot of high development. But polygamy is very characteristic of the studies of people at a certain level and cultures at a certain level. So it's interesting that we are open to revelation over time. Most people who are open to seeking altered states and seeking the mystical path will gradually translate at higher and higher and higher paths. And it's my experience that in my view, although some of our core ways that we express ourselves in the mainstream church may not be as high as they could be, that we have that openness, and over time we have a great deal of faith that we'll have an opportunity to continually enrich, and that we will have church leaders that over time will bring in more and more truth, and those truths will change, and the way they're manifested will change. And do I expect much dramatic doctrinal change in my lifetime? I really don't. But I certainly want to leave some integral seeds in that regard.
You're 22 minutes.
Okay, 22. The other is, I'll jump over to descending and tantric, and I'll just mention descending, and I know Lisa has thoughts on tantric and has read my paper, so maybe I'll leave that to her. But in the descending aspect, particularly as you come out of this non-dual and move into wisdom and compassion and things that are very familiar with us, but they're framed a little bit different, in the very deepest of the Eastern traditions, is something that's very startling, is that polar opposites, everything manifests in polar opposites, and those polar opposites are not good and bad. And one of the deep insights, the deep religious insights, spiritual insights that Joseph Smith had, was that there's opposition in all things. If there's going to be joy, there has to be sorrow. What the deeper sense you see, you just experience it, that this isn't good versus bad, is that they're necessary for one another. You come out of deep compassion, and out of that arises sorrow. Christ was a man of sorrows. It's an experience of the deepest empathy and sorrow for the suffering on all of the world. It comes directly out of compassion. Related to that, and connected to the depth of it, is joy, transcendent joy. It comes out of compassion. And both of them have to be experienced together. And so you have to embrace, for instance, ignorance and sorrow and death in order to more deeply embrace compassion, wisdom, joy, and the things of life. And every once in a while, a gospel doctrine class or something, somebody will come out with something like that. It's a little bit rare. But it's deep, and it's there. And it's in our tradition. And we wanted to leave some time for conversation. But what I'm trying to do is now get out to groups. I've been doing a word fireside. I'm trying to bring integral some of these deeper perspectives, integral perspectives, to people to say this is already in the spiritual field of our church and our tradition. And I have a little place with my son called the Vagabond Cafe in meeting rooms, and we're teaching these integral spiritual teachings. Indo-European root of bag, and vagabond is the way, so we're teaching the way. We're having an integral salon night for people on Tuesday nights who want to hear a really interesting talk with somebody. Any of you want to give a talk for a diverse audience, we invite you to do that. So anyway, this is just kind of an introduction of sort of these integral undercurrents in Mormon tradition that I'm very excited about and making a big part of my life, I think, for the rest of my life.
John has just taken you on an introductory journey toward Mormon wholeness, which he calls integral Mormonism. In any religious tradition, there are modes of understanding the body, mind, and spirit, and ways of seeing the self, culture, nature, and the divine. When we come to a religion through a child's eyes, we see the mode of faith as static. That is, we believe it is our task to become informed about how this religious system sees the body, mind, and spirit as they relate itself to culture, nature, and God, and then to adopt that mode as a reflection of right religious devotion. In other words, I went small between the lines, I'm bored with this. In other words, static faith comprehends a digital snapshot view of religion and seeks to conform itself to the individual pixels as we understand them. Our efforts to divine and adopt that static mode feel like the exercise of faith to us. These experiences of faith and devotion are a necessary stage in a journey toward a more dynamic faith. John has introduced an approach to the esoteric dimension of the Mormon tradition, a dimension where the mode of faith must eventually move beyond static response. He reminds us that we move from static faith to dynamic faith, not through the shaming question, is my current faith unacceptable, but through the question, does my current faith encompass enough in light of what life is asking of me through adversity, through relationship, through calls to creativity and compassion? Next one.
What is this? Water.
Yes. Water, that's what it is. Thank you. Dynamic faith, contrasted with static faith, looks at religion as a photograph with comprehensible, not just as a photograph with comprehensible pixels, but as fine artwork, where knowing the artist and the work of art are part of a process of knowing oneself. John's paper also sets forth a framework whereby we need neither be ashamed of our past static faith, nor be impatient with those who find in static faith a purposeful flowering of focus. It implies an invitation to be patient even with those who are threatened by faith that no longer finds fulfillment in static mode. John looks at Mormonism's radical differences from other major Western spiritual traditions and tells us that these points of departure can positively accelerate dynamic Mormon faith. This faith would, 1, help us achieve higher spiritual awareness, 2, embrace the world with activism, and 3, help us achieve a fully integrated, free-functioning life. Moreover, he seems to suggest that these outcomes are the destiny of a dynamic faith informed by the best ideas Mormonism offers. While I agree in theory and am enchanted to participate in one of many sessions here at Sunstone, which emphasize the optimistic and deeply affirming aspects of our gospel tradition, I share with John some concerns about obstacles which commonly appear in the Mormon experience of moving from static to dynamic faith. Stones in the path which lead from fractured functioning toward wholeness. Perhaps we have all noted obstacles which appear to deter typical Mormon seekers from the trajectory toward wholeness in dynamic faith. The first obstacle I will be looking at can be best discussed by looking at the requirement of wholeness with which Mormons may be most uncomfortable. Wholeness encompasses and appreciates all stages and experiences leading to it. That is, wholeness does not reject static faith, nor does it reject the twisted paths and unbalanced growth that may have preceded it. It does not resent the twisted paths and unbalanced growth of others who are obliviously moving toward wholeness. This patience is undergirded by the sense of destiny of wholeness implied in John's paper, as well as the more pointed spiritual experiences which infuse each of us with universal love. This first obstacle that I note is a panic that there is not enough time. I also wrote the margin here. Wholeness requires this universal love and patience, brings up the endemic difficulties in Mormonism that we may have in achieving. So now the first obstacle I note among us is a panic that there is not enough time. As involved Mormons, we are encouraged to urgently forsake mistakes and sins, regularly review our actions for the need to repentance, and we may experience anxiety about sins of omission or feel disturbed that a step in the wrong direction will take us and our loved ones 180 degrees away from our hoped for destination. While focus on improving our life's choices may lead to a more integrated functioning, panic that there is not enough time creates scrambled judgments and our desperation to have no empty chairs in heaven, to help ensure that we, as well as people we love, don't fail during our brief time on earth. This leads to harsh evaluations of others' modes of faith, impatience with others' learning experiences, and a judgment that certain stages of development are in fact unacceptable. None of us are impatient with a three-month-old child who hasn't yet learned to walk. And when our walking skills are fully developed, we still see the non-walking stage as perfectly acceptable. If we experience an accident which requires us to learn to walk again, we recognize and appreciate every little bit of progress made as a necessary step in relearning to walk. But when a child is 15 months old instead of 3, a harried mother is impatient at carrying that heavy child on her hip. She has a sense that it's time this child learned to walk. What makes the difference in the patience? It's a sense of time and our judgment of how much time a person should take to develop this or that skill or attribute. As Mormons, we may unconsciously share with the rest of the practical world a Newtonian limitation, which is decidedly anti-integral, anti-wholeness. Because we experience limited time in our day-to-day life, we may parse it grudgingly in spiritual time. Our scriptures, unfortunately, may seem to confirm this. This life is the time to prepare to meet God, and afterward comes the night wherein no work can be performed. If a man is cut off in the thought of infant baptism, for example, he cannot be saved. Certain mistakes appear to thrust us into an eternal hell from whence there can be no rescue. If God cannot look upon sin with the least degree of allowance, which of us can afford to do so, especially when eternity apparently may turn on a single mortal moment? The idea that 3 degrees of glory remain static throughout eternity may also panic our preparation, as if eternity were some extended function of time. You no doubt have correctly guessed that these undercurrents of Mormon consciousness appear to me to undercut the greater truths of Mormonism that God's timetable does not include time, that the word eternal does not describe any supposed finite attribute of God's life, and has no appropriate reference to time at all. As John's paper points out, the Mormon view that we are born not in original sin, but with divine destiny, should awaken in us the wholeness that encompasses each stage of development as patiently as we appreciate rosebuds or babies who do not yet walk. The Mormon doctrine that matter and spirit are not truly dichotomous, but inextricably related, should also inform us that our wholeness includes the body and its pleasures. Incorporating the best of Mormon doctrine, we do not need to reject that which is incomplete or unbalanced out of fear that God may cut us off forever if we have been temporarily deceived or have been deemed to have had chance enough and no more. This is the first obstacle to wholeness in the misunderstood aspects of our Mormon tradition as I see it. The second obstacle I note is that we see rejection itself as a recommended approach to that which we do not wish. The integral Mormonism to which John will draw us approaches that which is not wished in a radically different fashion. Integration does not fear the shadow, does not reject the shadow. It embraces what moves the shadow and seeks to integrate that moving force which appears opposite to it. A common interpretation, and I might say misinterpretation, of our faith is that we shun Satan, to shun Satan. We avoid all experience that would stain us. And we reject that which is non-praiseworthy, non-lovely, and of non-good report. As we cannot serve two masters, we seek to do as Christ directs, serve him, and reject Satan. Our propensity to do this, unfortunately, leads us to reject that which we may need to heal ourselves and others. We reject aspects of ourselves we do not know how to appreciate. We reject others as they symbolize aspects of ourselves we loathe, or shadows of which we are afraid. 50 years ago, the best conventional medicine offered for emotional trauma was to steel oneself to forget that an event ever happened. We now recognize that healing involves incorporating the pain into current compassionate consciousness, and that forgiveness involves fully understanding what has been lost. Family therapy now recognizes that one deviant family member may hold the truth that all members are suffering for want of recognizing. Our Mormon scriptures give us the framework for comprehending integration in 2 Nephi. To the extent that we see that all things have their opposites, and at the same time see beyond one encompassing all good and the other all bad, we begin to understand integration. Our temple teachings emphasize that truth is a compound of all things. This is the non-duality John speaks of, which is so central to the truths taught by Eastern Enlightenment. This is non-duality. This is integration. I love the recently rediscovered passage from earlier church history, which has been reprinted in the Insight at least 3 times in the past 15 years, reminding us that straying family members connected to us by temple covenants will never be lost. Whether in this life or the next, they will be sought after until they are included in the eternal family and are saved in the celestial kingdom. Since the goal of this institution is to connect the whole family of spirit children who have ever lived on this earth through temple covenants, the logical conclusion of this is that we will all eventually be connected and have the opportunity to be saved in the celestial kingdom. This idea reinforces the intimation that each soul has something precious to offer in its experience, its perceptions, its fully integrated function. This is practical yin yang, practical integration. John's paper calls us to tantric realization. For those of us with a less than integrated experience with the idea of tantric practice, it is helpful to define tantric. A web or union of opposites that, when united, become one with everything in the universe, moving both directions at the same time in an integrated manner. The movie Dark Crystal is a parallel of tantric realization. The two obstacles, our panic about time and our rejection or repression of healing or unifying polarities, seem to be our two greatest obstacles to wholeness. These obstacles lead us to a third, which John discussed, an obliviousness to the ethnocentrism we exhibit. The following knee-jerk reactions reveal our ethnocentrism. If we have ever thought to ourselves that people who don't agree with our viewpoint are free to leave, or that we would be better off without them, if we joke that world conflict might be resolved by the destruction of the people or a belief system, if we believe that it is a complement to others' beliefs, that they have a portion of our truth, if we imagine that those who complain simply do not understand, or when we respond to distress by attempting to explain how the distressed person should be responding to that which causes the distress, we are showing tendencies of ethnocentric or interpersonal obliviousness. Larry C. Jensen, professor of psychology at BYU, replicated Lawrence Kohlberg's assessment of moral reasoning among BYU students in 1977. Kohlberg's stages of moral development were built on Piaget's cognitive stages of development and led to James Fowler's developing stages of religious faith. The whole idea of stages is that each encompasses and builds on the necessary stages which must precede it. In other words, these frameworks imply integration and wholeness in their fulfillment. I helped Dr. Jensen tabulate the results of the BYU-Kohlberg assessment, which were disappointing. As a young idealist, I'd been certain that Mormons would have higher moral reasoning scores than the general population. And when that failed, that at least my own story would reflect something more. When that failed as well, I found fault with Colbert in his test. Uneasy in the idea that the faith that I was pursuing had taken me no further than that. I am now accepting of the idea that my faith may not lead quickly to wholeness and integration, which does not diminish my desire to act aggressively and decisively in the arenas where my judgment must be transformed into action. Hopefully, it expands my awareness, makes my actions more intentional and transparent, allows me to join with others in blessing and serving, and leads me toward the integration John Kessler has invited us all to.
Please, if you have questions or comments, or mostly I'm sure questions, but please come up to the microphone and share. You're all in the non-dual state. We don't know. We don't know which way we're at. Bell's coming up. Okay. He beat you.
Would you discuss the best ways to overcome these obstacles? How do we move cultural revenue centers into more directions you're talking about?
Well, I think each aspect has its own helpful integrally informing practices. In our physicalness, my observation is in the Mormon tradition, as much as we have a belief in the goodness of our natural proclivities and energies, we tend to repress the natural, we tend to repress the sensual. And so the question is, how do you overcome that? I mean, there are some wonderful practices relating to shadow. Some having to do with polarities in some of the work I do. Mary Beth Raines and others who are Mormon psychologists have wonderful practices in regard to stretches. In the interrelational area, and I was talking about going up, you just have to find stretching opportunities. The first thing is to how do we translate in a healthy way. Whatever stage you're at is just fine. Let's just try to get away from being pathological about it. That's the first step of integralness. Maybe that's even more important, is how do we grow, is how do we become healthy in a deeper environment. When I listened to President Hinckley speak, I listened to a very wise and spiritual man counseling us to be more compassionate and temperate and loving of our neighbors, but it just doesn't translate all the way down, so we have to find practices. In terms of working on the fear-based or the lower needs, the higher needs, towards greater realization. At least Ken Wilber's data, I haven't read much original work, but his summaries of data would say that meditation and contemplation move people faster, further than any other type of growth scenario. Most people take about 5 years if they're working on it to move up a level of development. Good meditative and contemplative practices can do that much, much more quickly. Part of it might be doctrinal, but I think a whole lot of it are practices, and it's almost like, let's pick one thing and talk about it, because each one of these areas on the ascending, descending, or tantric arenas require its own sort of stretching practices, but those are just a few preliminary responses.
Well, I didn't always count on him with a silent space, being there. I just wanted to say thank you, because I see something extremely important happening to our culture, the people who are bringing what I see as the gifts gathered in Israel, kind of like some of the ancient prophecies. And I think the sad part I've seen in our culture is that we've had our eyes shut to the gifts that everyone has to bring. All started making like us, and somehow some of people are opening their eyes and receiving the gifts that are coming at us. I have noticed many people who in past times got angry and searched other places for comfort other than the places that you found them. I, for one, got very mad at the church 100 years ago and found meditation and yoga and all sorts of amazing different practices that brought me so much peace. And I never had any sense that I would be able to share it with my community. So I am so thrilled to see some people who actually are heard and share. And thank you.
Come on.
I guess I'm kind of on the opposite then. I wonder what stage is it where one really doesn't want to go and try to. Is that a stage? Is that a valid stage? Because I've often thought, well, you know, I could go and I come here and I hear these things and I say, I can go back and be in this area to my community. And then I go once to Relief Society, it's where I'll never go back again. And so I just can't sit there. And I know that's got to be about me and not about them. Is that a valid stage? Or is that just being lazy?
Human being.
Well, I mean, the spirit of the response for me, as Melissa said, is that it's not for us or anybody to be judgmental about somebody living the life they want to live in a healthy, enjoyable way they want to live. We're too much about judgment. If we can translate our experience in a healthy way, I think that's great. On the other hand, if we accept the premise of the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we do have a responsibility to move towards divinity, even if it's just to turn around and help others become less miserable, less full of anxiety and pathology and sorrow, then I think in that context we have a responsibility for ourselves and for our fellow men to, if there's some wisdom there, we can help along the way. I think particularly that's the case in an environment where we can see the way we behave culturally is injurious to others. And I think that's maybe less evident in a place other than Utah. But certainly we act out collectively in ways that are very punishing and painful to others. And something that creates somewhat of an imperative, but at the same time, just so much appreciate the depth and thoughtfulness of Lisa's comments, that this really is about the Lord's perspective, that it's okay. But let people choose for themselves. It's okay to be who you are. And anything you want to do.
Your question's flippant, but I think the answer is pretty much the same as Lee's. What is it that we can do? In my experience, the motivation for doing something comes in relationship. We're very rarely motivated to do something dry or go teach someone we don't even know. The moments come when we are in a dynamic experience with another human being. In that Relief Society class, if there was one woman that you knew was suffering because of what she heard, you wouldn't mind being there with her, helping her. I know it's true. It's when we don't know what people's needs are, and we don't see what we can do to fill that, or we don't see what we can learn, that we tend to become dry and bored. And the more we know about people, the more we know what we can learn. And I don't know. But that's the short answer to the big question.
And
explained to this before. The closest I can come to it is an acronym called SPIES: spiritual, physical, intellectual, emotional, social. Just remember it. It doesn't mean anything.